This is Dan Barish, the Jewish liberal from Cleveland.
And this is Matt Shepard, the Mormon conservative from Seattle.
And we are the common ground. So, today
so
is
this is our sabbatical
podcast.
It's our second sabbatical podcast. And we're talking over each other.
Yes, but, well, we're liberal and conservative, and each of us both know that the other is wrong, and so the point is, much like daytime talk TV, to just, you know, talk over the other until the better one emerges, right?
Yeah, so, you know, it's the great quote from a great man, Weird Al Yankovic, everything you know is wrong.
Exactly, especially you, Matt.
Yeah, I know nothing.
Well, another
quote.
So,
the importance of being earnest. Anyway, so we've got a few points to bring up from old podcasts. So there's one on voting. I had a few points. It was the one I think I had the most points on. You know, we talked about how evidences of voter fraud and that sort of thing. And so there's a few instances of voter fraud and where, like, voter ID could help that I wanted to bring up. So there was a mayoral election from, I think it was like 5 or 10 years ago in Chicago. And, you know, the vote was decided by a fraction of 1% in this Chicago voter election, Chicago mayoral election. In that one election, there were 63 convictions and 100,000 fraudulent votes.
Wow.
In the Chicago election. Yeah, that was, you know, in one Chicago. This is just the city of Chicago. 100,000 fraudulent votes. So, like, there's a quip that President Obama said when he was talking about voter IDs. Like, this isn't Chicago. Well, this is the kind of thing that he's referring to when he says this isn't Chicago, because Chicago is known, it's probably the worst case scenario for voter fraud. But, so there's another one, there's Georgia. So from the election, comparing like the last similar election to the next election after they had passed voter ID, the black vote actually went up by 43%. At least in the case of Georgia, it didn't suppress the vote. You know, so there was an increase of black people voting after they employed voter ID laws. You know, and I was missing some statistics that I wanted to. I said that it was a popular thing, but there is a somewhat recent voter ID poll. 75% of blacks in that poll approved of voter ID laws. And it was only 19% of all people disapproved. And so it was, you know, just getting some numbers on that. And there's one more system that I wanted to bring up, the California vote. So in California, every time you sign up for any kind of welfare benefit in California, mm-hmm. in the stack of paperwork they hand you is a voter registration form. And so anytime you're signing up for welfare, you also get a voter registration form. On that form, it asks, are you a citizen of the United States or are you eligible to vote? And if you click yes, then you're registered to vote. If you circle no, then you get a letter. They send you a letter that says, are you sure you're not eligible to vote? And if you don't respond, they automatically register you to vote.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's, you know, the whole system, it's like, you know, you could be illegal or, you know, and if you're honest, but just forget to respond to that one letter, they automatically register you to vote. So you're on the voter rolls. And they don't have very many checks to find out if people are registered to vote multiple times. And so there are many instances where people will sign up for welfare benefits again, and then they'll get re-registered to vote. And so they'll be registered multiple times. You know, so, I mean, that's the sort of thing that you know, want to try to crack down on, is I want everybody to be able to vote. I want everybody to be able to vote, but I don't want people to be able to vote more than once and right. or if you're not eligible to vote, you shouldn't be able to vote.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, you know, so, yeah, I want it to be a free and fair election, but, you know, not riddled with fraud, which is kind of what a lot of the voter ID is trying to affect. If there are better ways of getting rid of voter fraud, then great. But at least for in-person voting, it seems to be one of the better deterrents. Anyway, that's the stuff I had on voting.
Okay. So, did you want me to bring in my stuff now, or?
We'll bring in your stuff now, so.
Right, so, the only thing was, for me, I've been thinking for the last few days, you know, one big divide, I think, between liberals and conservatives is that I think that conservatives, to a greater extent than liberals, trust the market to police itself. And that's true across labor laws, across environment stuff, just all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is less true for liberals. I think conservatives and liberals both view power in and of itself as a possible disease that can corrode any system. You know, just the natural corruptibility of humans. I mean, people can become corrupt whether they're conservative or liberal.
Yes.
So we both feel a need to restrain the government. Liberals and conservatives, especially the libertarian conservatives, I think can agree on the need to restrain the surveillance state as much as possible while still keeping ourselves safe.
Mm-hmm.
But liberals tend to like big government, including myself, and the reason we like it, if we want to put it that way, is that we think there are problems big enough that only government can really scale enough to solve them, like mass hunger or whatnot, or poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and so there are things where I do trust the market to police itself. Random example, I had a debate with somebody once, more like a quick discussion, about Mayor Bloomberg's now failed attempt to ban, you know, that really big size of sugary drinks in New York City, big Slurpee cups or whatever.
Yeah, any drinks over 16 ounces.
Right, and I thought that that was, you know, just a really excessive application of nanny state liberalism. I think, yes, it's unhealthy,
yeah.
But if we're going to start legislating based on the mayor's opinion of what I really need and what will keep me healthy, well, I guess you should have to get some license, a special, just so that you can drive your SUV, because quite frankly, are you going to be going off-road in your mall? Well, no, not really. And if you need a big family carrier, just get yourself a minivan. I mean, I think SUVs are kind of silly unless you're going off-road. But it's not my judgment to make. I mean, I wish that they would only be bought when used because they're gas guzzlers and we don't need those. And I kind of hate being around them on the road. But
as in, for instance, just to goad you, Dan, my family didn't fit in a minivan. There are no minivans that have 9 seats, but our Suburban did have 9 seats. So,
well, that's different. Well, your family had an above average number of children.
Yeah, I've also met families that they drive in a passenger van because that's the only thing that'll fit them.
Hey, sure. My college used to have Earlham College, that is my undergrad alma mater. Used to use 15 passenger vans, but then they retired them when one of them got into an accident going to, of course, the School of the Americas protest. So,
yeah,
anyway, that's with the whole big cup thing, you know, I think that these companies should be free to try to sell any size they feel free to. And the example I made at the time was, you know what, if they want to market a 10-gallon drum of Slurpee soft drink, well, let them, and I think it will fail. I think I don't want to deal with rolling home a 10-gallon drum of sugary crap. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
sell what the market will bear. I don't care. It's not my job to decide what you get to sell.
Yeah, that's, you know, like the 64-ounce Slurpees, you know.
Right, so, you know, I think that 10-gallon drum is totally going to fail in the market. So I think that the market can police itself in the sense of products that should fail because they're inferior and nobody wants them. The market will totally police that. A lot of these stupid startups are going to die once the venture capitalists dry up. There's some really useless startups out there.
Yes.
You know,
there's always been useless startups, and that's part of the part of figuring out what the market wants is you have to try new things, and if you never try new things, then the market gets nowhere.
Exactly. So
if you're trying new things, there's going to be some failures.
Right. So I do trust the market to police itself in that way. What I don't trust it at all to do is to police irresponsible, destructive behavior that is nonetheless highly profitable. A random example being strip mining. If it's the best way to extract those resources, and if nobody can stop them, they're absolutely going to do it. Ask the state of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So we as liberals, I think we could state almost monolithically, do not trust the market to police itself. We feel that the power of government is needed as a restraint, not just on itself in the form of checks and balances, but we also believe that big government is the only thing that can restrain big business from being psychopathically dangerous. Mm-hmm. I know you've
so
talked about
it. I have an interesting thing on the West Virginia thing. Have you ever been to West Virginia, Dan?
Oh, very much. In fact, a substantial part of my family is from West Virginia, and I spent many happy childhood vacations in Wheeling. So, oh yes, I know West Virginia, and I've driven through it quite a few times.
Okay. So, one of the arguments that people have for strip mining in West Virginia is that West Virginia has almost no flat land at all.
Oh, true. I used to love rolling on those hills.
Uh-huh. And so
I got old and too nauseous.
Part of their thing is that the strip mining can be used to create some of that usable land. So in some ways, it's potentially improving the land as opposed to destroying it.
That's not an improvement. Propose. That's a destruction of it. I mean, the problem with strip mining is erosion. Is you're ruining the land, actually. If by improving you mean let's make everything flat like it is in the Midwest. Well, if you
I'm not saying that that's what their ultimate goal is. I'm just saying that is one argument that people use
I am personally in love with the rolling hills of West Virginia, and I don't consider flatness an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I think that, you know, plundering the environment for this resource and then getting up and leaving when you're all done taking what you want isn't responsible stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the sheer amount of mine accidents that happens because, I mean, we now have all these federal indictments against Massey Energy, which, you know, really did not take responsible care of its workers. Safety precautions abandoned, mm-hmm. people warned to cover up when inspectors came around, all that sort of thing. I think the West mm-hmm. Virginia coal mining industry is a great example of the fact that the market doesn't police itself much of the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are definitely abuses, and I think that those abuses should be dealt with. And so that's one, it's one thing that I would like to have with competition. So a lot of these coal mining areas, they basically own a specific area, and it's the only place that people can go to work to make any decent kind of money in a lot of places in West Virginia.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
and
it's...
so there's no competition, and so it creates a monopsony. So it's the opposite of a monopoly. So a monopoly is where you control the whole market, the whole, like, distribution market. Where a monopsony is... I may have the word wrong, but it's where you control the whole labor market. And so that creates abuses of power and that sort of thing. So that's where, you know, they tell the workers to cover up and things, because the workers have nowhere else to go. You know, the entire town is based around this mine. So if this mine closes down, it's, you know, their whole family has to move and change. And so it creates those abuses of power. Or it allows those abuses of power to happen much more than in, you know, an instance where there's, you know, several mining communities that are competing near each other, or several, like,
if
industries
I,
that are competing
if
near each
I
other.
May interrupt, I just searched. A monopsony is a situation in which the monopsonist can dictate terms to its suppliers, sort of like what's going on with Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about controlling the labor market, it's about you get to tell your suppliers how much they're going to sell to you for example.
Okay, thank you for looking that up. There is a word in which there is a person that controls the labor market. Rusty on my economics right now. Can't remember the term for it. But, you know, that sort of situation allows for much more abuse than in a situation where, you know, if you're working in... I mean, you're working at McDonald's in a regular city, like, and you have an abusive boss. You can go work for Burger King across the street, and, you know, get a very similar sort of thing, and maybe they'll have a better boss. And
you're, or maybe you they won't. Be, maybe won't they'll have an even worse boss who beats you up instead of just yells at you. I mean, you don't know.
That's possible. I mean, so it's, you know, but that's the sort of thing where you can actually leave and find a better thing. Whereas basically when the cost of leaving is so high that people will take abuse, I think is where it does create problems. And so there needs to be some sort of checking force, whether that's a union or the government stepping in, or another company coming in and doing things better and not destroying the environment so people will like them better.
Speaking of unions and coal mining, here's a bit of trivia that I actually learned from John McCutcheon, a folk singer, that is to say. Do you know, Matt and listeners, the first use of bombing, as an aerial bombing, that is to say, in the United States ever?
Like, where something was aerially bombed in the United States?
Yeah.
As an act of warfare, it would have to be after 1903.
What'd you say?
It would have to be after 1903, that's for sure.
Well, the first powered flight was 1902.
Yeah, well, they didn't start doing anything with it till late 1903.
Right. Anyway, so, never mind, I digress. It was actually against coal miners. It was a union a union-busting action. That's, you know, that's one chapter in a very long book of, unfortunately, a history much of the time, especially under Republican administrations, but certainly not solely under Republican administrations, of the government in arm with big corporate America, as opposed to acting as a check against the abusive market.
Yes, and I will go out on a limb here. Well, not on a limb. Like, Republicans are just as often in bed with big corporations, or if not more often than liberals. And I think that's one of the issues I have with the Republican Party.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I mean, both the Republican and the Democratic parties have their coalitions that they're in bed with. The Democrats, at least since the time of the New Deal, and maybe before then, I'm rusty on my labor history, have been in bed with labor. And there's good and bad things there. It means that the Democratic Party is reticent to admit that the unions can sometimes be in the wrong, but it also means that the unions have an advocate in D.C. sometimes, and it also means that the Democrats have a substantial get-out-the-vote force ready-made when they need it, and if the unions feel like But and then also trial lawyers. I mean, each party has its basis, and, you know, the Republican Party, you know, has, you know, both, I sort of see the fiscally conservative base, but also the socially conservative base, and sometimes these two forces can probably get grossed out at each other because they're not at all in the same. You know, I know some people who are totally grossed out that the Republicans even care about abortion or about gay marriage, and would rather just see a balanced budget and growth-promoting policies, and think that the Republican Party needs to stay out of the bedroom and out of the doctor's office. And I'm sympathetic to those people.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one thing that we're discussing here. The market tends to work out a lot of abuses if the people have morality. I've mentioned this before many times. Adam Smith's first book was about moral sentiments, was that we need to have morality in order to have the invisible hand work into the betterment of people. You know, the market does do a lot of work, even if the people are corrupt. It does work towards some betterness, but it doesn't really It does its best when the people have their own morality. And so in times when there is a lack of morality or a moral issues amongst the people, then the market can be a driver for evil, such as in the time of the Nazis, there are many business owners that put other people out of business, or, you know, put people to shame. There's lots of, you know, during the Jim Crow laws, maybe that's partially with the government, but there were also businesses that were complicit in that.
Oh, of course.
And those sort of things. I mean, there's then there's things like Enron, where they lose their morality as a company. And so then they start to try to cover up their mistakes as opposed to admitting them and moving on and, you know, taking the fall for it. I think that's one of the big problems with the capitalism when, like, with the market is when there, it's not a transparent market, people will try to take advantage of that.
Right.
And so,
you know, I think with me as a liberal, I think that there's very, very few companies that I see as motivated by morality.
But they just have to be not, you know, like the companies can often be amoral and still be okay. It's when they start to be, to not have, to not care at all, or to, you know, want to, you know, not think what they're doing is immoral when it is. When you have people that are beating children to go into mines, I mean, that's immoral, but the people didn't see it as that. And so that's a lack of morality amongst the people of the, you know, that are running the company, that are working in it.
Oh, well, either that or they do see it as that and they think, so what?
Yeah. So that's, there's the, you know, too much indifference and or enough of a antagonistic morality can cause problems. So we have to need to have a significant portion of the population be moral in order for it to do a lot of the things that the market needs to do.
And unfortunately, moral means different things to different people. Like, you look at one of the few corporations that I see as mostly ethical most of the time, Apple, where do they focus their energy on being moral? They focus it on being pro-gay rights. They focus it on spending a lot of money to make everything be environmentally sustainable and all that sort of thing. But for some people...
But then you have things like Foxconn.
Foxconn, exactly. Exactly. Although it turned out that what's-his-face, who was exposing Apple's allegedly awful working conditions, was actually making it all up. But that doesn't obviate the fact that the Foxconn factories, for example, have suicide nets, which is just disturbing that someone felt the need to build those things.
Yeah.
I think Apple's, you know, factory morality is at the very least a work in progress, but by that same token, since Foxconn does device building for many companies, I have zero patience for somebody telling me, well, Samsung is better than Apple or Amazon is better than Apple. No, they're at least as bad, if probably not worse. At least Samsung. I don't know.
There are abuses in the electronics industry that are, you know, difficult to figure that out. But that's, I think, another issue for another day. Right. So on the fact of, like, unions, kind of on, as an aside, I had a couple of things. One, you said that in Wisconsin, the worker salary or the teacher salaries have been plummeting.
So I read, yes.
I went in and looked at the numbers. I went in and calculated the numbers, basically, of average teacher salaries across Wisconsin by year. So basically what it looks like is instead of them getting slashed, it's they used to have the average teacher's salary went up about $1,000 per year before Scott Walker came in, and after Scott Walker, it's been about flat.
Well, that's a problem because that would mean they wouldn't be keeping rise with the rate of inflation, although inflation isn't rising, but nonetheless...
So I mean, it's a cut in future salaries, not you know, their salaries have gone up, like from 2010, which was the year before he got in, and to 2014, it went up about $900. It's over that 4 year period.
$900 over 4 years is not a lot of money. So what's the average?
That's the average teacher's salary. So there are teachers that are retiring. And there are new teachers that come in. So, I mean, that could possibly just be that a lot of people decided to retire. And so there's, you know, so the people that are older and on higher salaries are out, and there's new people on lower salaries that came in. So there's, you know, which could be that, you know, they saw Scott Walker coming in and were like, I'm going to get out before, you know, maybe pension issues, or there's potentially a lot of issues that could have caused that as well. but it's their salaries aren't like plummeting.
Well, there's a lot of things that affect teacher pay. Just if you're looking at the public schools, the way pay scales work is they're affected primarily by two things. They're affected by years of experience, not of grade level that you teach, but years of experience, and they're affected by what your level of education is. So that if you have a bachelor's, well, first of all, they're going to want to have you'd have a master's minimal. That's most public districts will take somebody with a BA, but they would prefer that you come in with a master's, and some districts will wait for you to earn a master's for a few years with the expectation that you're going to have one. And if you have a doctorate, then you get paid even more, but good luck getting hired with the PhD, because I'd rather have the master's teacher and spend less money. And actually, one interesting thing that I can share with you, because I've spent a long time learning about the history of public education in the United States, one of the big reasons teachers unionized in the early 20th century is that it used to be that you actually got paid more or less depending which grade level you taught. A first grade teacher was going to get paid less than a high school teacher. And teachers,
which is still true, but
that was like a standardized thing that happened, as opposed to whatever the title of a job is. And in fact, I mean, the way teacher education works is that there's an entirely different certification for teaching younger children versus older children, partly because, of course, the classroom teacher in the second grade needs to be versatile across many topics. They need to be able to teach math and social studies and language arts, whereas a high school teacher might just be social studies.
Yeah, so, you know, the specialization versus, you know, lightly generalization. So there's a couple. So a couple other things. Net neutrality topic. The Gibson guitar, they, you know, Sam pointed out, and it is true, the Gibson guitar didn't have all the right paperwork. There were some issues that they had, so it wasn't completely unjustified. And the Detroit Farrier, they do actually have horses in the Detroit police department. So the actually does do some things.
Later on, we're going to get a sound effect so that we can have, you know, a whipping sound effect and beat when either of us take our ceremonial beating with a wet noodle for getting a fact wrong. No, we're actually going to have a whip crack sound effect later when we make these mistakes. I'm going to take Matt out back and beat him after we're done with this. I'll fly to Seattle and beat him. But anyway,
So one thing that Sam has mentioned several times regarding like abortion. In the case of an artificial womb, which is supposedly we're getting somewhat close to, would you be against abortion in the case of an artificial womb?
I hadn't even thought of that. I need some time to think about that. That's not a snap decision that I can make.
Yeah, it was just an interesting point of thought.
My quick thought is that it's a standalone womb in a lab. Is that what you're talking about? Just a standalone womb sitting in a lab?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, then there's certainly nobody's personal autonomy that's being threatened other than the baby. So I certainly think that a lot of the anti-abortion argument gets its legs. I mean, excuse me, the pro-choice argument gets many of its legs cut off. At that point, that's my initial reaction, but I'd want to see some arguments from ethicists, if there are any, arguing for a pro-choice perspective even with an artificial womb. I'd never thought of it. I guess I don't think of scenarios that can't be plausible at this present time, although sci-fi is very good for that.
Yeah. So that's an interesting topic. We also didn't do a final common ground on the over-sexualization, rape culture podcast.
Oh, we didn't come to consensus?
Yeah, it didn't come to consensus at the end of the episode, which was requested.
Oh, yes, yes.
So, I think, you know, basically our consensus on that is, you know, don't sexualize people. I mean, don't treat people as objects.
Absolutely.
And don't encourage that sort of
Unless they want to. In the context of satire, I mean, there are contexts where it might be appropriate, where that's the whole point of the exercise, but in our culture there is far, far too much of it. And I think that before we even get to a place where it's okay to somehow treat somebody as an object in a certain context, I don't know what that might be. I'm just saying these things. You can't plan for all scenarios, is all I'm really saying there.
Mm-hmm.
But before we even find it acceptable to go there, we need to get our rampant sexism under control. There's a Twitter mm-hmm. handle that I follow called Everyday Sexism, and it's just this. It's just women posting about being catcalled and groped and everything that happens to them, and you just begin to have some small appreciation for how it might be just to walk around and be female. Not that these things happen to my wife, actually, but
yeah.
The point being, there are things we as men just don't experience.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we need to be, as a nation, a little more harsh on a lot of the Middle East. We are big supporters of Saudi Arabia, which has a large train of abuses against women.
It's all about the oil, baby. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But, you know, this is one of the reasons that I'm for energy independence, or getting, you know, North American energy independence as much as possible.
Right, because then we don't have to be in
there. We don't have to. With because, Saudi Arabia.
Right, and then we don't have to be in bed with the Saudi royal family and the Wahhabi clerics that they support. Exactly.
Exactly.
So, yes, the difference in the common ground would be what that energy independence would preferably look like. But we can talk about that at a later time, too.
Yeah, I mean, mine is basically any kind of energy that we can use that's not going to, literally kill us is on the table.
But whether it'll kill us in 100 years or 500 years versus right now, that's kind of the liberal difference.
Well, for instance, we can get into this in another topic, another thing, because that's going to open a whole can of worms. Did you have anything else to bring up, Dan?
I'm right, you're wrong, that's all there is to it. Anyway, this is Dan Barish, the Jewish liberal from Cleveland, signing off.
And this is Matt Shepard, the Mormon conservative from Seattle, signing off.